From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, more revelations about a multi-million-dollar advocacy group associated with Governor Cuomo. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, will share his thoughts on those revelations, and lawmakers in both houses draft bills to crack down on anonymous comments on blogs and websites. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. One day before the State Ethics Commission was to hold hearings on new rules for lobbying disclosures, there were more revelations about a multi-million-dollar advocacy group associated with Governor Cuomo. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
A lobbying group closely allied with the policies of Governor Andrew Cuomo has been in the news a lot in the past couple of days in articles raising questions about multi-million dollar donations to the group known as the Committee to Save New York and policies later advocated by the governor. The New York Times first reported that the gambling conglomerate Genting donated over $2 million to the committee just weeks before Cuomo made Genting's plan to build a casino and convention center in Queens the centerpiece of his State of the State plan. The Buffalo News reports that a major Buffalo business association in 2011 solicited nearly $1 million in bundled donations for the Committee to Save New York. Cuomo awarded Buffalo $1 billion in economic development grants in his State of the State, the only upstate city to receive the money. But under current rules, the committee does not have to publicly say who gave them donations to carry out a $12 million ad and other promotional campaign. The newspaper reports come as the recently formed State Ethics Commission is holding hearings on new rules to require greater disclosure from groups like the Committee to Save New York, as well as more conventional lobbyists. The New York Public Interest Research Group's Russ Haven plans to testify at the hearing. He says the use of groups like the Committee to Save New York, known as 501c4s, to advance political and public policy ideas isn't new. Healthcare organizations have used them, he says. But he says what's different about the Committee to Save New York is that instead of being against politicians' policies, it is now in lockstep with one of them.
Often it was groups joining forces to do battle with the governor. In this case, you have a consortium of business groups that have come together to align themselves closely with the governor's priorities and make a public push for them. So that is new.
The Wall Street Journal reports that even before Genting made the $2 million in donations to the Committee to Save New York, top company executives pitched their idea to Cuomo in a slide presentation at a private fundraiser held for the governor in Westchester County last October. Sue Lerner with Common Cause says the revelations contribute to an atmosphere of cynicism and skepticism and raise questions about whether a pay-to-play culture exists in New York.
What I think is disquieting is that this was a meeting that took place as a fundraiser. So it seems as if the price of getting the governor's ear is a campaign contribution. And ordinary New Yorkers don't have the price of admission.
Lerner, who also plans to speak at Thursday's Ethics Commission hearing, says full disclosure is necessary and as soon as possible.
The least we can do is have complete transparency. The public needs to know who is spending these huge amounts of money to try and influence public policy, and certainly when the public is the target of all of this advertising. They need to know absolutely who's writing the checks and who's speaking to them.
Haven with NYPERG believes, based on his study of the new law that sets up the Ethics Commission, that the public likely won't see details of any donations to the Committee to Save New York from 2011. He predicts the Ethics Commission will be limited to only requiring new donor information going forward, or at the most, donations that occurred in the current calendar year.
A reasonable interpretation certainly wouldn't be earlier than starting in January 2012.
Earlier this week, Governor Cuomo said talks between Genting and his administration over the Queens Convention Center had broken down, and he would now wait until expanded gambling is actually legalized in New York State and then take open bids to operate casinos and build convention centers. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, this week, we just heard it from our Capitol correspondent, Karen DeWitt. Published reports, Alan, recount a meeting between Governor Andrew Cuomo and Malaysian gambling interests at an event kept off Cuomo's public schedule as he pushed to expand gambling. The Wall Street Journal now reporting, Alan, Cuomo met with the chairman of Genting in October. 3 months later, Cuomo adopted Genting's plan for a $4 billion convention center and casino at Aqueduct Racetrack.
But it doesn't stop there, does it? Because then we found out about certain monies that were given by Genting to the group that Andrew Cuomo was using to mobilize public opinion on. And so what we see there is the potential for this kind of abuse. It was one of the reasons, by the way, that when the excellent controller of New York, Tom DiNapoli, objected to a provision that Andrew Cuomo had in the budget bill, which was that the controller, for the first time now in modern times, was not going to be allowed to audit pre-audit contracts. So now you begin to get the idea. If the smell is there, every governor, if I were the governor, maybe I would want it. I don't know, but I'm not, and he is. And he's got a massive public opinion approval rate of 72%. I don't know that everybody's in love with the guy, but they think he's effective. But when they start to read that he met with these people, that there was no official record of it, that they put money into something that he wanted them to put money into, which would help advance his politics and his political career, then it begins to stink. And I think that is the big problem for him now. Now, we know it was a tough thing because he renounced the contract. He announced the deal and said he was going to put it out to a lot more people. Now, who knows whether he was the one who did it or whether his people did it? Because I know when you're a CEO, in the end, you have to sit there. And if somebody's done something, you have to take it on your staff. You have to take responsibility for it. But it is not an attractive thing. And I think he probably learned a lesson here.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York lawmakers have drafted bills in the Senate and Assembly which would crack down on anonymous commenters on blogs and websites. We get more from the Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas.
Under the proposed legislation, New York-based websites would be required to hold off publishing comments posted by readers who declined to identify themselves. No more anonymous reactions to blog posts or newspaper articles. Instead, those wishing to weigh in would have to attach a legal name to any comment, along with their home address, as well as their computer's IP address. The legislation is sponsored by two Republicans, Chemung County Senator Tom O'Mara of Big Flats and Long Island Assemblyman Dean Murray. Lissa Harris is the founding editor of the Watershed Post, an online news site that serves the Catskills region. Harris believes the bill runs counter to the spirit of the First Amendment and likely would not stand up in court if challenged.
If you look back at the history of political discourse in this country, you will see a lot of anonymous discourse that had it not been allowed to exist and flourish, I think you would have seen things play out historically in a very different way.
Harris notes that the Watershed Post employs Facebook comments.
Mostly because most people on Facebook are using their real names, and that actually, we find, helps keep our comment sections a lot more civil, and it also gets rid of a lot of the spam that we were dealing with. So I have to say that having commenters use their real names is good for us. But that being said, I really don't think that this bill makes any sense. That might sound like a contradiction. I don't think that it is.
Many politicians use Facebook, Twitter, and other offerings on the internet in both campaigning and disseminating information to constituents. Dutchess County legislator Joel Tyner weighs in.
I can understand to an extent the sentiment behind this legislation, but I would say that this is a step too far, a bridge too far. And if you go back, you know, a couple hundred years, the Federalist Papers, you know, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, John Jay, those were the three guys who wrote the Federalist Papers, but they were published anonymously.
Emily Donahue is the online editor at the Saratogian newspaper.
We've gotten comments from city employees who wouldn't be able to use their names, who give us useful information, people who are involved with a crime story on one side of it or the other, who don't feel comfortable using their names, and giving them an opportunity to voice their opinion in a forum where they don't have to attach their name to it, I think that's still valuable. It needs to be policed. It needs to be monitored because it can go out of control, but I think there's still a place for anonymous commenting.
Bill's sponsor, Assemblyman Dean Murray, says he needs to clear the air surrounding the legislation.
Okay, first and foremost, let's clarify that it would not ban all anonymous comments on the internet. 95% of the anonymous postings would still be allowed under this legislation. The only way that an anonymous posting would in fact be removed would be if the target of that posting reached out to the administrator of the site and indicated that the posting was inaccurate. So what we're going after is those that are posting malicious lies and slander, hiding behind an anonymous pseudonym.
Murray says nothing is more important than free speech.
However, I don't believe that guarantees the freedom to lie and slander other people while hiding behind an anonymous screen name. And keep in mind that the comment can only be challenged, if you will, under the basis that it's not factual. So opinions are completely protected.
It's worthwhile to note that while the First Amendment doesn't specifically address anonymous speech, the Electronic Frontier Foundation points out that the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled that the right to anonymous free speech is protected by it.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
About 100 towns in New York State have passed laws that ban gas drilling. Most of the bans are temporary. About 20 are permanent. In the first installment of a two-part series, the Innovation Trail's Matt Richmond reports on the two Ithaca lawyers whose work laid the groundwork for those drilling bans.
Before moving to Ithaca in 1999, Helen and David Slache were real estate lawyers at a firm in Boston. Now middle-aged, Helen says they came to upstate New York to get away from the world of corporate law and to work with her brother-in-law's small company.
You know, bucolic upstate New York, family company, a switch from a big city corporate practice to sort of small town, nice bucolic existence.
But slowly she got pulled into a more hectic world, the world of local people opposed to hydraulic fracturing. It all started when the Slaches went looking for a farmhouse for David's brother. Everywhere they went, the sellers had leased their mineral rights to an oil and gas company.
And the real estate broker said, oh, don't worry, you know, everything around here's got to get, it's really nothing to worry about. And David, having practiced law in Texas, was like, there's no such thing as an insignificant, don't worry about it, oil and gas lease.
So they started worrying about it. Helen joined an email list with people organizing against fracking in New York. Then she took up a fight against an industry project in Chemung County. And 2 years ago, she started working with the Tompkins County Council of Governments as it prepared for drilling in the area.
One of the natural links, you know, was that David and I could work on what sort of local laws might towns pass. So we got started on that, but with the real focus on lighting or noise laws or dust laws, air pollution laws. But a very important part of that question was, what does regulate mean?
Under New York law, the State Department of Environmental Conservation is given the sole authority to regulate the oil and gas industry, with only a couple of exceptions. That means towns can't say how the industry operates within their borders. That power resides with the state. The rationale behind the law is to make things easier for industry by avoiding a patchwork of local regulations across the state. So the Slotchays figured towns could adopt a single law in the form of a ban and get around that problem.
It was too complicated to have all these different layers of local regulation, and they could do this here, they could do that there. It was like, well, do they understand no? Like, is that too complicated for the gas companies?
When the Slotchays realized that was the course to take, they wrote a legal rationale and model zoning laws that have spread across the state. Today, their Ithaca office is two desks squeezed into the bit of open space that isn't taken up by stacks and stacks of paper. Ever since two county courts in the state upheld local bans, Helen says they've been getting calls every day from towns looking for help. For each of the 80 or so towns they've worked with, they go through the zoning code and each town's master plan. They'll write a draft with the proposed zoning changes, and when invited, the Slotchays speak at town board meetings.
So we work 7 days a week. Might have taken a day or two here or there over the past year.
The Slotchays work for towns for free, but receive outside grant money to pay for their work. They've been criticized by landowners groups for receiving money from the Ithaca-based Park Foundation, which bankrolls many anti-fracking groups. David Slotchay doesn't usually speak to the press. That's Helen's job. But during an interview at a coffee shop in Ithaca, he shared his plans for the future.
If you look at the history of you know, resource extraction in this country, whether you're talking about mountaintop coal removal or any of these things, these guys don't give up. There's money to be made. They're going to keep going until they get, you know, kicked in the butt out of town.
It's not clear yet that their work will hold. Both cases involving the local bans are under appeal, and the bans could still be thrown out. And everywhere in New York that the Slotchays go, the opposition to their work is getting louder. In part two, we'll hear from that opposition.
That's the Innovation Trail's Matt Richmond reporting. Support for the Innovation Trail comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Innovation Trail is a collaboration between five upstate public media outlets reporting about New York's innovation economy. You can hear more at innovationtrail.org. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York's Attorney General was in Plattsburgh recently to announce the results of a regional investigation into contractor compliance with the State Home Improvements Contract Law. Attorney General Schneiderman said, what was discovered in New York's North Country is of statewide concern. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley.
New York State passed a law in 1988 requiring that contractors performing any type of home improvement must provide a written contract before beginning any project. The contract must describe exactly what work will be done, what materials will be used, and the start and completion dates. It must be signed by both the homeowner and contractor with a 3-day right to cancel. The law also requires that deposits for the work be kept in a separate account. They cannot be placed in a contractor's general account. Due to a high volume of complaints, the North Country Regional Attorney General's Office began an educational campaign, notifying over 400 contractors of the law. 2 years later, the number of complaints had not diminished. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says they began a formal investigation last May and characterized the results as astounding.
We found that the overwhelming majority failed to follow the most basic provisions of the law. Many had no contracts at all. And as to the consumers, most of them had no idea that the home improvement contracts law even existed. So all over the state, people hire contractors without a signed contract, and people often end up with bills that are much larger than what they anticipated and, frankly, than what they were told the bill would be.
Settlements have been reached with 47 contractors in Clinton, Essex, and Franklin counties. Attorney General Schneiderman hopes this announcement educates consumers about their rights.
Unfortunately, not enough consumers are familiar with this law, and not enough contractors abide by it. And we think this is going to set a model for the rest of the state of what you have to do to inform consumers and to send a message to contractors.
Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Plattsburgh Regional Office, Glenn Michaels, says despite their earlier outreach, most violations were due to ignorance about the law.
We know that there are hundreds, maybe thousands, of part-time contractors out there. When one comes to our attention, we deal with the situation. What we're hoping is that through this announcement and through the fact that contractors have been hit with some substantial fines, they're going to tell their fellow contractors, hey, you have to have a written contract, you have to have a separate bank account for consumer deposits. The goal is to raise the standard of awareness among contractors and also among consumers. So when a consumer is approached by a contractor and is not getting a written contract that complies with the law, they're going to say, hey, why aren't you following the law? That's what our goal is, to have everybody knowledgeable of the situation and playing on the same playing field.
Northeast Irrigation and Landscape owner Chris Lefebvre says he's pleased that the Attorney General investigated.
Keeps everybody on the same playing field. As a home improvement contractor, we put a lot of effort in marketing our services and products. And I would say it further solidifies that we're trying to be on the up and up and keeping the homeowner abreast of what we're obliged to.
Assistant Attorney General Glenn Michaels says the contractors that have been fined are not necessarily unscrupulous. They simply were not following the law.
We saw many honest contractors. We've never had a complaint about their work who did not follow the law. However, if the law isn't enforced, it allows lots of room for the bad guys to slip in and to cause problems for everybody. So it's not that we're targeting good contractors. We're enforcing the law generally, but it's a good law, and it helps to weed out misunderstandings among good contractors, and it helps to minimize problems with the bad apples.
A contractor is responsible for all subcontractors following the provisions of the Home Improvements Contract Law. Out-of-state contractors doing work in New York are subject to the law.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies of the program are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That number again, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1223. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.